something that maybe a lot of people don't even think about. So today will be, as John described, illuminated.
Yeah.
My brother John Books. Yeah. So definitely we can learn a lot from them. Even for the Christians among us, we can really strengthen our convictions about our Bible. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Dr. John Books.
Thanks, it's good being with you today. My voice is, I'm losing it a little bit. I got a bit of a cold, but hopefully we'll get through. We'll pray about that. It's great being here in Singapore. It's my second time here, and I look forward to coming back ever since I was here. It's a great, beautiful city. You'll enjoy being here. But everywhere I go, and I've been all over the world. I've been in so many places. But everywhere I go, my favorite thing is the Christians that I meet there. And you're the most beautiful thing about Singapore. That's my opinion. Now, I want to continue. How many of you were at the talk last night? About a third of you. Okay. So, to some extent, this is really just continuing on with that talk. And I was trying to present kind of this conflict that exists because so many people out there in the world think that Christianity is for foolish people who don't know what they're talking about. You know, they think that if you're not very educated, maybe you become a Christian, but if you really had a PhD, then forget it. You'd never ever, how could you believe in the Bible? That's a very common thing. I told a story, I'll tell it again, about I was on in a van going to a science meeting with a bunch of science professors, and a typical attitude, it was all science professors, so they thought they could talk this way, it'd be okay, not knowing that I was there. So this lady said, you know, Christianity, what a stupid, how could anybody believe it? It's so stupid. I can't believe it. She said, for example, it says in the Bible that if you wear clothing of two or more materials, capital punishment. What kind of stupid religion is that? So I said, excuse me, but actually the Bible doesn't say that. She's there, yeah, whatever, you know. I saw it on the internet. As if that would decide. So I said, no, actually, you know, because I hear people saying things about the Bible. They say the Bible's full of all kinds of science errors. But, you know, I've read it through half a dozen times. I haven't found one yet. I don't know what they're talking about. And I said, as for that passage, you know, so I opened up my Bible. All right. I don't know if you could. This is the challenge I get last night. How many of you could find that one in Leviticus about clothing with two materials? Could you find that one? Did you know it's even there? So I opened right to that passage and I read it. And I said, yeah, so a lot of people say stuff about the Bible, but I think it's because they don't know what they're talking about. Ooh, it got really quiet in there. And then we started talking about some science experiment, I don't know. But it's typical. People, ha 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 ha. They're laughing. Ha 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 ha. But I want to turn that around because I want to give you the idea that we should be the ones who are thinking, of course, we won't go ha 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 to those foolish people that don't believe in God. That's not very godly. That's not kind, right? But really, we should be the one who are confident. And the reason people don't believe in the Bible is not because the evidence isn't there. They're going to have to answer to God for why they don't believe in the Bible. So, the name of this talk was the Bible from God or man, but you gave me the title, Rational Christianity. It's really the same idea. In other words, is it rational to believe the Bible is what it says it is, the Word of God? All right, I'm going to give you an invitation. We have a conference. I don't know how many of you can get to Irvine in June, but the fourth year running, we have our Christian Evidences Conference. It's a great event. We bring speakers from all over the world. You're invited to that. And if it's too far to go, then go to our website. We have an apologetic certificate program we're offering. You can get a certificate in Christian apologetics. Just go to my website. Everybody got my card, right? All right, so anyway, we're going back to this slide we saw last night. Oops, that's right. This is very confusing. I have to forward two at once. So it's hard for me to think. You know, I have sometimes breathing and talking at the same time. It's really hard for me to do that. Doing two things at once. Anyway, so we saw this quote last night, and to me it represents the typical attitude, especially at the university. And those of you who are in high school, you're going to go off to the university, you're going to hear this thought like, ah, that's for ignorant people. You know, and so here's Dulles McCown. He says, Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, its reputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. This is what people say. The Bible is a historical lie. I mean, it's full of fables and legends. My response to that is, which fable, which legend? I haven't found one yet. What are you talking about? I'm thinking you probably didn't read the Bible, either that or you read it with such biased eyes that you're reading into it something that's not there. But specifically, I want to talk about the Bible being supposedly scientifically unsupported and insupportable. Now, the second point, which is it's philosophically suspect at best, that was last night's talk. And last night we talked about how I believe the Christian view of the world is by far the best philosophy that we have available to us, and that there's not even a decent comparison. Anyway, so let's talk about the Bible being scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. You've heard this, right? The Bible's full of all kinds of myths, and obviously a scientist would laugh at the Bible. And my response to that is, well, where are those scientific errors? I mean, I've got a PhD. I've read the whole Bible, I don't know how many times. You know, you would think I would have found one of those by now. Surely it's there. All right, so here's the... this is going to be really hard for me to do this. Wait a minute. Did we skip? There we go, Papyrus Ebers. Now, the Papyrus Ebers is a document that was put together by the Egyptians. It was written roughly 1,500 BC, and it's a compendium of all the knowledge of medicine in Egypt in that time. Scholars would tell us that probably the Egyptians had the most advanced medical knowledge in that time. All right, and in fact, the Egyptians did brain surgery. They actually figured out a few things. And it's important to think about this because, first of all, this was written about the time that Moses lived. All right, and it was written in the place where Moses lived and where he was educated. Now, let's look at some of the prescriptions in Papyrus Ebers. It says, to prevent hair from turning gray, anoint it with the blood of a calf which has been boiled in oil or with the fat of a rattlesnake. Now, what do you think about that? I'm used to picking somebody out in the audience as a good example, but you're a bunch of young people. There's no gray hair out there. All right, we got a little gray hair. You've been using that stuff? Obviously not. All right, a mixture of six fats, mainly those of the horse, the hippopotamus, the crocodile, the cat, the snake, and the ibex to prevent hair loss. Now, obviously, I've not been using that. Now, I don't know. I assume the men did this so that they would be attractive to the women. But women, would you spend time around a guy who's got that stuff on his head? It smells bad. That's funny, but you know what? It's not funny, really. If you think about it, it's not funny at all. Because what was the average lifespan back then? Probably 25 years old. Why? Because so many people died of infectious diseases. And they had no idea. People would just get sick and they would die. And the Egyptians, their medicine, they had stuff like this. Let's look at some of the other things that were used as medicine, according to Papyrus Ebers. Oops, this thing seems to... Is he going for it?
Trying to help you.
Oh, all right. We have to decide if he's going to help me or not. So, you help me and I won't touch it, okay? Good, we're in the same place. Because he can watch, yeah. So is he going to do it and not me? All right, good. Good, so lizard's blood, swine's teeth, putrid meat. So they have meat go rotten and then they would use that as medicine. What do you think? Moisture from pig's ears. And how about excrement? Yes, they use human excrement. So you got an infection, take some poop there and kind of smear it around. Great. Now here's my point. Listen carefully. Because people laugh at the Bible. They say, oh, the Bible, it's just human knowledge. You know, just like any other religion. Now if that were true, then I guarantee you there would be things like this in the Bible. I guarantee it. How do I know that? Because you can read any of the ancient writings. In fact, I'll have some quotes from Jewish writings outside of the Bible. And they have nonsense like this. And if the Bible was what people say it is, there'd be things like this in there. And the fact is, there simply is not. Not ever. Not even once. All right. Wow, he's quick. I hit the button and... Anyway, Exodus 15:26. This is one of these passages you read and you wouldn't really notice what's going on. What he says here is, if you obey all the laws I'm giving you today, this is God to his people, then I will not bring on you any of the diseases of the neighbors around you. And God gave a lot of laws that are related to health. And in every case, those laws make perfect sense from a scientific perspective. Now, one thing you notice is, think about it, how many cultures that were around 3,500 years ago are still around? Let me think. The Chinese culture, okay. The Egyptian, maybe the Indian, and then the Jews. I mean, the Jews don't seem to fit in that category. You know what I'm saying? They're getting pushed all around. I think one of the reasons is because they followed the laws that God gave them. They lived longer. They had more children. All right? And people would try to wipe them out, and they just kept coming back like weeds. But and the thing is, you'll never ever find any science errors, and you have all this medical wisdom. I'm just going to look at a few examples. There's many more, just a few examples, because I want to talk about a few other things. So, for example, in Leviticus 11, it says, the pig is unclean for you, those who walk on their paws, the weasel, the rat. And you can read the whole passage there in Leviticus 11. He lists several kinds of meats that they can't eat, and then several kinds of meats that he can't eat. Now, it just so happens that almost every meat on the list that you can't eat carries many, many diseases. And the meats that are on the list that you can eat are relatively safe. For example, pork. Now, I know they eat a lot of pork, especially in China, yes? And of course, all the people around them ate pork, but the Jews didn't. And scientists have found 22 different diseases in pork alone, trichinosis being the most famous. Now, I'm not trying to make you paranoid or worried about it, because with our modern technologies, you know, if you're careful, but even then, cook the pork all the way to the middle, yes? But then there's beef. You can eat it raw. I was in Venezuela 2 years ago, and you know, I speak Spanish, but there was stuff on the menu. I didn't know what it was, so I just said, give me that one. And they brought a whole plate full of raw beef. And I thought, well, Leviticus 11. And in Leviticus 11 it says, the meat of carnivores is, you can't eat it. And all meat from carnivores carries many, many diseases. It says shellfish, no good. And shellfish, by the way, can be very dangerous, as you probably know. But it says fish with scales, no problem, you can eat that. And we all know sushi, raw fish, is relatively safe. So it just so happens that everything it says you can't eat, most of those are quite dangerous. All the ones on the can eat list are relatively safe. Now, the way I see it, there's two possibilities. Luck or the Bible's inspired by God. I just don't see any other choices there. And luck just doesn't work very well. Now, if this was the only example, the fact is, all the people around them ate all of these things. Okay? And you in Singapore, you eat more things even than we eat in America, I think. But because the Jews did not eat those things, they lived longer, they lived healthier, they had more children. And what's interesting is God gave them all these laws, and he didn't say why. He didn't say, don't eat pork because of trichinosis. He just said, don't eat pork. What's interesting is each of these laws has a spiritual significance, and at the same time, it gave them health. And God is amazing in that way. Okay, let's look at another. Oh, this is a Jewish writing. All right, and just to show you that it's not like the Jews somehow were better at medical things or something like that. Maybe some people would say that. So here's a quote from a Jewish medical treatise. I'll just read the second one. The gnat, feeble creature, taking in food but never secreting it. Now let's stop there. What this is saying is that gnats don't have poop. Now is that true? Any experts on that? Is that true? No, that's a science error right there. That's a science error. Of course, that's not in the Bible, because the Bible never has science errors. Never does. All right? Anyway, so the gnat eating food but never pooping is a specific against the poison of a viper. So if you get bitten by a snake, you take flies, you crush them up and put it on there, and that solves the problem. What do you think? You think that's going to work? And I think what they had to do is they had to keep the flies in a jar. Because if you get bitten by a snake, what are you going to do? Try to catch some flies or something like that? I don't know. Instead, what we have in the Bible is Numbers 19. Look at this. It says, whoever touches the dead body of anyone will be unclean for 7 days. He must purify himself with the water on the third and the seventh day, take some hyssop, dip it in the water, and sprinkle the tent and furnishings and the people who were there. This seems kind of harsh, really. What we're saying is, if you help prepare the body for the funeral, then you had to be separate from the people for 7 days. You couldn't go around anybody. It seems kind of cruel and harsh. Why would God do that? It's just mean or something like that. But I want to give it a little bit of a scientific context. This is Ignaz Semmelweis. He's a doctor who worked in a hospital in Vienna in the 1840s, 1850s actually. And in the hospital he worked in, 18%, it was a woman's hospital, 18% of the women who came into the hospital died in the hospital. That's a very bad rate there. And what they were getting was called puerperal fever. Well, what Semmelweis noticed is the doctors, they had this habit, they'd come in the morning and they'd do autopsies on the women who died the day before, and they would proceed immediately upstairs to the wards and start examining the patients. So what Semmelweis said, if you touch a dead body, you're unclean. And you clean your hands with soap and water, the death rate in that hospital went down to 4%. Now the Bible also says when a woman gives birth or when she has her period, she's unclean. Sounds like Bible, typical Bible, woman-hating Bible stuff. No, not at all. Not at all. Because when a woman gives birth, she's very, very susceptible to infection. Think about how many women's lives were saved because God gave this law. So what Semmelweis says is, not only do you have to wash your hands carefully with soap and water every time you touch a dead body, you have to clean your hands with soap and water every time you touch any patient. And we kind of go, duh, it's so obvious, but not to them at all. See, back then, they didn't know about germs. Right. Now, did God say in Numbers 11, did he say, do this because of the germs? No, he just said, do it. Did he say why? No, he didn't say why. But I'm telling you, thousands, tens of thousands of lives were saved. So Semmelweis said that, and the death rate went down to 0.5%. Now, of course, medical science had no explanation for this. They said it's the alignment of the planets. It's because the women have constipation. It's because they're hysterical. That's what it is. It's because the women are hysterical. Typical male attitude, you know? The Bible doesn't say, but when they washed their hands, when they followed the Bible's prescription, if you will, then the death rate went down to 0.5%. Actually, it says 0.5%, actually. So you would think that they would have declared Semmelweis a hero and all that, but no, instead the doctors rebelled. They refused to wash their hands. They fired him, and he died of an infection 6 months later. Now, the prescription... Sorry, you can't see the structure very well. Oops. Next slide. All right, good. Yeah, no, there we go. There we go, that one there. So anyway, I'm sorry you can't see it very well. The background's not right. But the prescription God said was ashes from the heifer sacrifice, water, and oil of hyssop. Now, hyssop is an herb. It's similar to thyme, you know, the herb thyme. And hyssop has a lot of oil in it. In fact, if you take the oil from the hyssop and water and ashes, you make soap. That's how grandma made soap. But it just so happens that this specific herb, hyssop, has 10% in its oil of thymol. Now, I teach organic chemistry, and when I teach organic chemistry, we call molecules in that category, we call them phenols. The six-membered ring with a little OH on there, that's called a phenol. And when I teach about phenols, the first property I tell them is that they're powerful antiseptics. So you know that smell in a hospital? You know that smell? You're smelling thymol or there's other ones, Cresol and others. That's what you're smelling. In other words, God's prescription was if you touch a dead body, you clean yourself all over with a powerful antibacterial soap. Yeah. Ah. Now, how did Moses know to use hyssop? Do you think he maybe did some experiments? He tried lots and lots of different herbs to see if it would kill germs? I don't think so. There's many others. I'm skipping several because I have to get onto other topics. But this is one of my favorites. In Genesis 17 it says, from generations to come, every male among you who is 8 days old must be circumcised. Ouch! Ooh, painful. Dangerous even, yes? Well, maybe, but actually, many, many lives were saved because of this. In fact, think about it. most everybody back then, nowadays people die from heart disease, cancer, things like that, diabetes. Back then almost everybody died from infectious diseases. We're talking about bacteria and yeast. And where does bacteria and yeast grow? In warm, dark, wet places, yes? So where's the warmest, darkest, wettest place on a guy? All right, yeah, never mind. We'll change the subject here. All right? And just think, just simply by circumcision, how many lives were saved? Never mind just not just the venereal diseases, but many other diseases. All right, so probably that's why God said to do it. Of course, today, whether you circumcise your male child or not is not so big of a deal. I assume most of you guys take a shower once in a while, okay? Okay, are we good on that? So the health benefits are not quite as great. Although it prevents a certain kind of cancer. In fact, they've done a study, even AIDS, the transmission of AIDS is lowered by almost 50% simply if people are circumcised. All right? But why the eighth day? That's the thing, is why the eighth day? That's you know, why not the first day? In fact, think about it. To the Jews, the number one was kind of, the number three that it kind of spiritual significance, right? Three. So why not the third, or seven? You know, seven was, why the eighth day? Now, of course, God didn't say why. And He didn't say why to circumcise. Although circumcision has a spiritual meaning as well. Because circumcision in the Old Testament is a foreshadow of baptism in the New Testament. Circumcision was how they became part of the people of God. Baptism today is how we become part of the people of God. So there's a spiritual meaning, but of course there's also a health implication. It turns out that when babies are born, if they're cut, they tend to bleed to death very, very easily. The reason is that vitamin K does not pass from mother to child. It just doesn't. It doesn't go through the placenta. And without vitamin K, then you don't make prothrombin, which is mentioned there. And the vitamin K isn't what causes the clot. It's the prothrombin. That's the protein that does that. So babies have a small amount of prothrombin, but no vitamin K at all when they're born. So if you were to do a circumcision the day a child is born, there would be a very high rate of them dying. Then what happens is, and by the way, we get our vitamin K from bacteria that are in our large intestine. So baby's born, baby eats from mommy, gets lots and lots of bacteria. 3 or 4 days later, the vitamin K level starts to come up. And then the prothrombin level that went practically to zero, the second and third day are even more dangerous than the first day. Then the prothrombin level starts to go up, and then it reaches an unusually high level, and then it drops off. Now guess what the safest day in the entire life of a male child is to circumcise them. This is a graph of prothrombin level versus time. And by the way, the ninth day would work just fine. Alright? Again, how is it that Abraham knew circumcision on the eighth day? Now, when children are born, they give them a shot of vitamin K. The day they're born, they give them a shot of vitamin K. Because doctors have figured this out. How did Abraham know this? Now, here's how he figured it out. See, what he actually did was he did an experiment. He did a double-blind experiment. I'm just kidding. All right. That's a joke. So people say, the Bible, come, how could a scientist possibly be in the Bible? Because there's all these blatant science errors. And I say, oh, really? All right, fine. If you said that, can you show me one example? You know, you're so confident. Instead, what I see is amazing wisdom. Not just wisdom from the point of view of medicine. I could talk about Genesis 1. I could talk about other things if you wanted. All right? They say the Bible. So our friend Dallas McCown said the Bible is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable. I say, really? You know, where else do you see other than the Bible where it says, according to God, God said, let there be light, and there was light. And then physicists in the 1950s, they finally discovered, well, guess what? It looks like that's probably how the universe started. Big flash of light, the Big Bang. Hebrews 11:3 said it all along. Hebrews 11:3 says, by faith we know that what is seen was made from things that are unseen. I see great scientific wisdom right there. All right, now, proposition number two. That's the one, you know, the one that I read earlier from Dallas McKay. Says, ha, 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 philosophy, science, history, how could anybody believe in the Bible? Now, I talked about philosophy last night. So ask somebody who raised their hand a few minutes ago, or you could go to my website and get that outline. That'd be fine. I want to go on to the second thing. He says, Christianity is historically fraudulent. And this is what people say. Christianity is a bunch of stories made up by Jewish teachers who wanted to make their kids obey them. And they say, you know, David, how could you believe in David? And, Jonah went to Nineveh? Hittites, Hivites, Jebusites, Amalekites, Horites, all that. Yeah, just a bunch of stories. Ha ha ha. And then if you look at actual history, you kind of go, gee, where did they get this idea? The Bible's full is historically fraudulent. I say the Old Testament is by far, without any comparison, not even close, the Old Testament is by far the most accurate history we have of the ancient world. That's the truth. People say it's full of myths and legends and fables. My response to that is, which one? Which one? Now, Jesus told parables, but he was, you know, those are parables. That's different. All right, for example, who would say the Hittites? And the Hittites are mentioned something like, I don't know, 27 times, I think it is. Doesn't really matter. Something like 27 times in the Old Testament the Hittites are mentioned. And yet, historians said there were no such thing as the Hittites. And the Hivites and the Jebusites, you know about those. And so they said, you know, whatever. Yeah, and it talks about Abraham buying land from the Hittites and Uriah the Hittite. There's no such thing. And then in 1906, Hugo Winkler discovered Hattusha, which is the capital of the Hittite Empire. In fact, dozens of Hittite cities have been found, and the Hittite Empire basically took up most of what would be Turkey today, and also northern Syria and parts of Lebanon. And in fact, it was the largest rival to the Egyptians and to the Assyrians. It was a huge empire. All right, so much for that being a fable. In fact, here are the city gates of this city that people laughed about the Bible because it says there's no such thing. In fact, did you know that you can actually get a major at some universities in Hittite language today? This is this fantasy, this fable. People used to say there was no such thing as Nineveh. Well, they don't say that anymore. And of course, they say other things like Moses. How could you believe there's no such person as Moses? And the whole idea that the Jews left Egypt, they were in slavery. And there's no historical backing for that. Bunch of stories. Now, my response to that is, oh, really? Now, I'll admit, there's many events in the Old Testament I can't prove from history. I mean, history of our knowledge of ancient history is relatively small if you kind of measure it out. But it just so happens that every time the Bible says something that has historical information, we can check it out. It's always right. In fact, Genesis is written from the perspective of somebody who lived in the Middle East. I'm sorry, in Mesopotamia. How do you know that? Because we can read the Gilgamesh epic, we can read the Code of Hammurabi, and the kinds of things you see in Genesis reflect Mesopotamia. But then the time of Moses, like Exodus, it reflects the culture of Egypt. And if somebody were writing this 1,000 years later in Palestine, how would they have known all those things? Here's another example. And then the whole Sodom and Gomorrah. Again, people who are skeptics of the Bible, they laugh at that old story about the fire and the brimstone. That's just a nice story to tell the children. You better obey, because think about Sodom and Gomorrah. And if you read the account, Abraham takes the bad land, and Lot takes the good land down by the Dead Sea. If you go to the Dead Sea today, you go, good land? Dead Sea? It is one of the most desolate places on the entire earth. And you couldn't imagine farming being there. And yet in Genesis it says it was the best land where all the farming was. And so people, as always, say, the Bible, you know, typical story made up. Now, in Genesis, it describes five cities. Because there was a war, and Abraham and Lot went with these five, the kings of the five cities from around the Dead Sea, and fought a battle against the king of Elam. Now, in the 60s, there was an archaeologist doing some studies around the Dead Sea. What he found out is, 2000 BC, the Dead Sea was more than twice the size it is today. You can see the old shoreline, and then the shoreline it had back then. And it wasn't a wet area. It was a fairly dry area, but there was enough water coming in through the streams. They had irrigation. In fact, they had very intense agriculture. Guess how many cities they discovered? Five. Five of them, that's right. The largest one is up, the one in the upper right, almost certainly it's the city of Sodom. And here's what they discovered to their amazement, but for us believers it's not amazing at all, that all five cities were destroyed around 2000 BC by fire and never ever occupied again. In fact, I think it's called Sittim there, but we call it Sodom. It was covered with ashes as much as 8 feet thick. A mile away from Sodom, there was a graveyard. Now, let's be honest about it. In the ancient days, cities being burned down was not that unusual. Now, for all of them to be burned down and never ever occupied again in the same time frame as the Bible describes it, that's pretty good. But it turns out, at the same time, the graveyard was burned to the ground and the buildings were burned from the top to the bottom. All right, you get that? The buildings burned not from the bottom to the top, which is what happens when you light a building on fire. They were burned from the top to the bottom. So what we have is almost like a smoking gun for a miraculous event that's described in the Bible. And they say, the Bible's historically fraudulent. I say, oh, really? Now, here's what those who don't appreciate the Bible and are trying to cut it down. Where do they get this idea? You know, when Dallas McCown says the Bible is historically fraudulent, where did he get that idea? I think he got it from his friends or from his head or whatever. I'd say almost certainly not from reading the Bible, and certainly not from reading the Bible and studying history. Not at all. That doesn't make sense to me at all. And so here's what they'll do is they'll say, oh yeah, this is a fable, this is a legend. And then you find proof, and they just stop using that example, and they just use another example. Right. Then you find some evidence for that, when they stop using that one, and then they just use some other examples. You know, at some point you think, I think it's because they have an agenda here. What is their agenda? I don't know, ask them. I don't know. So again, people would say the story of David. And I'm telling you, as recently as 30 or 40 years ago, it was the standard thing for archaeologists to say, King David. There's no evidence that King David ever existed. And the whole idea of the descendants of David, and the whole idea of the Messiah came through that, that's just a story they made up around 400 BC. And then they found the Tel Dan inscription. A friend of mine, Dr. Wilson, is a professor at Pepperdine University. He was in the city of Dan the day this was discovered. In fact, he said he actually walked by this same stone that same day. It turns out the sun was at the wrong angle. And the Tel Dan inscription is found in the city of Dan. And there's actually two cities of Dan. This is the one at Dan that's up near the Sea of Galilee. And I'm going to read the inscription on the Tel Dan inscription. It says, I, Hazael, killed Joram, son of Omri, and I defeated Ahaziah of the house of David. So what we have here is, first of all, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And specifically, the southern kingdom was ruled by the house of David. In other words, what he's saying is, there was a king named David, and his descendants were the rulers of Judah, and specifically Ahaziah. By the way, you can read about this. You just read about it in 1 Kings... where's my reference? Oh, there it is. It's up there. 2 Kings 8, 28 and 29. Now, it's interesting because Hazael, and you can read about Hazael, he's there. He was the king of Syria, of Damascus. He says that he killed Joram. It's not true. Because if you read 2 Kings 8, he injured Joram. Joram fled from the battle, and then Jehu killed Joram. Now, here's my question. Which is more reliable, Hazael's account or the Bible account? The answer is, that's an easy question. And surely these people who say they can't believe the Bible, surely they know well enough that obviously we're going to have to believe the Bible's version. Why? Because the Bible is always right. And most other ancient historians, when they wrote us a biased story. If you read the histories of the Assyrians and the Babylonians, they never lost a battle. Well, who did ever lose a battle then, you know? It was very biased. Then you read Jewish history. Did the Jews ever lose a battle in their history? Yeah, like most of the time. Were their leaders perfect? How about the sermon today, huh? See, the Bible totally stands out. In fact, I think the only explanation that's possible is that it's inspired by God. That's my opinion. All right, people would say, you know, Pilate never... I'm not kidding, because the Romans did not have a specific record of Pontius Pilate being procurator of Judea. And then in the 1970s, I believe it was, in the city of Caesarea, they found what's called the Pilate inscription. And it says, Tiberius Pilatus Procuratus. In other words, in the time of King Tiberius, Pontius Pilate was the procurator of Judea. All right, well, maybe we're going to start to believe that. One more example. I could give you so many examples. The Bible's littered with these things. You can see it's the Ziggurat and Ur. This is, Ur is the city that Abraham was born in. This refers to Daniel. And I'll tell you right now, those who want to attack the Bible, they go after Daniel first of all. And if you read my book on Daniel, you'll see why. Because if Daniel is what it says it is, which is a prophecy written by Daniel, then if you don't see that as being inspired by God, then you're not paying attention, because the prophecies are ridiculously specific. So what they say is, well, Daniel was written around 150 BC. The reason they say that is not because there's any evidence. Trust me, there's no evidence it was written 150 BC. The reason they say that is because the prophecies that are in there. All right, and you know, the prophecies about Antiochus Epiphanes and all that. And so they say it was written 400 years after these events. And besides, there was no such person as Daniel. Come on, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach. Come on, it's just a story. And besides, in the book of Daniel, specifically in chapter 5, verse 7, it mentions this guy Belshazzar as king. You read Daniel 5. That's the story about the writing on the wall. And it has Belshazzar. So Daniel says the last king of Babylon was Belshazzar. And the archaeologists say, well, there you go. Who the heck's Belshazzar? No such person. Everybody knows the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. Herodotus, the great Greek historian, says the last king of Babylon was Herodotus. Several other ancient historians say the last king of Babylon was Nabonidus. The Bible says it was Belshazzar. And then fairly recently they found an inscription in the Ziggurat and Ur, and what it tells the story is this. Nabonidus was officially the last king of Babylon, but soon after he came to the throne, he lost interest in being king, and he got into mysticism. He went out to the city of Sin. I'm not kidding, the city of Sin, but didn't mean Sin, the moon god. And he became like this mystic, studying the moon god and worshiping the moon god, and he left his son Belshazzar to be regent, to rule as king. In fact, Belshazzar ruled as the effective king for 17 years. How do we know that? Because it says that in the Ziggurat there in Ur. Now, if you read the book of Daniel, chapter 5, you'll notice that Belshazzar says to Daniel, if you can translate the writing on the wall, I'm going to give you the third place in the kingdom. Right? Not the second place, the third place. Well, why the third place? Because who occupied the second place in the kingdom? Belshazzar. But here's my point. Because people say, oh, the Bible is just a bunch of fables and legends made up. Daniel's written 400 years later. So historians were unanimous, first of all, that there was no such person as Belshazzar. Second of all, that Nabonidus was the last king. So how did the writer of Daniel know that Daniel could only be the third in the kingdom? You see? So, people say the Bible is historically fraudulent, and to that I say, maybe you could help me out with some examples here. And of course, there are still plenty of things that are in the Bible from the Old Testament that haven't been proved yet. You know, I can't prove to you that Noah built an ark. I can't prove that to you. But you know what? At some point, you have enough examples, enough evidence, then you start to believe that the benefit of the doubt should be given. You know, I can't prove to you that Jesus said this particular word on this particular day. You know, did somebody have a tape recording? But I say, as I look at the Old Testament, it is so by such a vast measure superior as history to any other ancient history, that the only explanation I could have, it's the obvious thing, that is inspired by God. Now, I've got a couple more propositions I want to look at. Do you hear the same people say the Bible is full of all kinds of contradictions? How can you trust it? I mean, those Bible writers, they should have talked to each other. They should have worked it out before they tried to tell us this. You know, they should have checked out their stories. It's kind of like two witnesses from a crime, and they should kind of work out their story there before they tell it to us. My response to that is, oh, really? Which contradictions? All right, and people, you know, and you hear that. I go out on the internet, you see all these websites, and they say, you know, the Bible with thousands of contradictions. How could anybody trust it? But then what you do is you start reading what their contradictions are. For example, in Genesis 7:17, it says the flood lasted for 40 days. And Genesis 8:3, it said it lasts 150 days. Well, there you go. So, because surely there were two different stories and they just sort of joined them together and didn't fix it. Now, so which is it? Did the flood last for 40 days or 150 days? And my answer is, come on. I mean, come on. Because, see, it rained for 40 days. Oops, I keep putting my finger on that thing here. All right, can I go back to it? There we go. Oops, went too far. Oh, he's trying to fix my... There we go. It rained for 40 days, and the floods rose for 150 days. And after 150 days, they started to recede, which makes perfect sense. Then there's Genesis 27:36, and here it says, Joseph was sold as a slave to the Midianites. But then there's Genesis 39, which says, Joseph was sold as a slave to the Ishmaelites. All right? So, and believe me, these are the kinds of contradictions you find. All right, now, let me see. I met somebody from the Philippines. Where? All right. Yeah. What's the island? Where is she? All right, what's the island you're from?
Catanduanes.
So, are you Catanduanes or are you Filipino?
I'm Picolana.
Whatever that means. Does it? It turns out that the Midianites were Ishmaelites. And this is their contradiction. See, you can tell when somebody's case is bad when every example they use is obviously not a very good example. And there's so many of them. Like Matthew 27:5, it says that Judas hanged himself. But in Acts 1:18, it says, no, his body fell to the ground and burst open. Well, how about this? Maybe he hanged himself, and after he hung there in the tropical heat for 3 days, when they cut his body down and it fell, do you think it might have been bloated and possibly burst open? All right. To be honest with you, there are contradictions in the Bible that are a little bit hard to understand. But you know what? My experience with those is when you understand how they're both true, you actually have a deeper understanding of the Bible. For example, in Exodus 20:4-5, it says, when the father sins, the punishment falls on his children, his grandchildren, down to the fourth generation. You got that? That's Exodus 20:4-5. It says, when the father sins, the consequences fall on his children, his grandchildren, down to the fourth generation. But in Ezekiel 18, it says, the son does not suffer for the sin of his father, neither does the father suffer for the sin of his son. So I say, you know, it seems like whoever wrote Ezekiel should have been checking his notes, should have been reading Exodus before he wrote that. You know, that's a bit harder one to understand, isn't it? But here's the explanation. See, what we're learning in this Exodus 20 is physical consequences. In other words, if you sin, you're not the only one who suffers. If the father beats his wife, who suffers? The father, the wife, the children, the grandchildren. In fact, there's a sense in which Exodus 20 is almost like common sense. So he's not talking about eternal consequences. He's talking about in this life, if you sin, you're not the only one who's going to suffer. It follows down behind you to the generations after you. But in Ezekiel 18, he's talking about spiritual consequences. All right? And when it comes to eternity, you will face God for your sins and nobody else's. Okay, last one. People say, you know, Jesus, he's just a myth. In fact, we had at our apologetics conferences, we set up several different debates. Our debate last year was with this guy, Robert Price, who confidently declares that Jesus is a myth. Now, why anybody would want to publicly defend that idea, I really don't know. That's a really tough one to defend. So I want to talk about Jesus who fulfilled the messianic prophecies. Now, Luke 24:44, Jesus said to them, "This is what I told you while I was still with you. Everything must be fulfilled that is written about me in the law of Moses, the prophets, and the Psalms." So Jesus said, "You know what? I have to make sure that I fulfill all the prophecies of the Messiah." Jesus says, every single one of the prophecies about the Messiah, I'm going to fulfill those. In fact, if you read in John 5, he says, the whole Old Testament was written about me. Think about the arrogance of Jesus to say that. And yet, it's true, as I gave that lesson a couple years ago when I was here. So I want to think about that a little bit. And let's try to be skeptical. Let's say, well, maybe what happened was they wrote the prophecies after Jesus did it. Does that make any sense? No, because we have the Dead Sea Scrolls. And besides, who owns the Old Testament, really? The answer is the Jews own the Old Testament. Do you think the Jews would have changed the Old Testament to agree that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies? I don't think so. And some people would say, well, how do you know these things really happened? How do you know Jesus really was crucified, etc.? Well, what we're going to see is that over half of these prophecies that Jesus fulfilled, their fulfillment is a matter of historical record. Another one is, maybe what Jesus did was he would see, all right, I'll read Isaiah 53. It says I need to be silent before my accusers. Okay, let me be silent. Now, one problem with that is, because he was silent, what happened? Because he was silent when he was accused, what happened? They killed him. That's not a very good plan. If your plan is to be this great, hallowed, praised Messiah, the problem with that is it involves getting killed. You know what I'm saying? Besides, we're going to see several of these prophecies he fulfilled. It wasn't actually him who did it. In fact, it wasn't even within his own control. So Isaiah 53, it says, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, familiar with suffering." Does that describe Jesus? Would that be a reasonable description? Is there some question historically whether this is really true? Do historians question whether Jesus was despised and rejected? Okay, in fact, Tacitus says that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. And it says in Isaiah 53, he was pierced for our transgressions. Now, what's that a prophecy of? What happened to Jesus? You can read that in John 19. See, what happened is there were three men on the crosses, and because it was the eve of the Passover, the Jews said, we need to get these guys down off the cross. So what they did was they came up to break their legs, right? And we'll see in Psalms 22, the psalmist says, I can count all my bones, which is a prophecy. In fact, did you know for 1,500 years, when the Jews did the Passover lamb, they didn't break open any of the bones. Again, that was a prophecy of Jesus not having his legs broken. But they came up to Jesus and he was already dead, and they pierced his side with a spear. Now, let's just imagine Jesus thinking, all right, now there's a prophecy in Isaiah 53, I have to get pierced. But the problem is, I'm going to be dead already. So maybe what he did, he said to the soldiers, by the way, after I die, could you do me a favor? Could you make sure you pierce me in the side? Now, that's funny, but see, these skeptics that don't believe in Jesus, how do they deal with this stuff? I think they just ignore it. Or they'll say, well, this is not a prophecy of the Messiah. Now, if you could read Isaiah 53 and not think that's a prophecy of the Messiah, then I don't know how to talk about that. He was oppressed and afflicted and yet did not open his mouth. Now, we know that happened. I suppose you could argue as a skeptic, well, Jesus wanted to make sure he didn't open his mouth. All right. Now, did Jesus act in a way that would get him despised and rejected? Did Jesus do stuff that was sure to get him despised and rejected? Yeah. Claiming to be the Son of God, yeah. Casting the animals out of the temple, I think so. All right, here's another one. Micah 5:2. Micah 5:2, it says, "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from ancient times." And you can tell from the context, this is clearly the prophecy of the Messiah. It's about somebody whose origin was, he's the ruler of Israel, he's going to be king of Israel. It says he's going to be from Bethlehem Ephrathah. Now, where was Jesus born? Which Bethlehem? There's two Bethlehems. Do you know there's two Bethlehems? He was born in the smaller Bethlehem. Bethlehem Ephrathah, of course. So now, if you want to be the Messiah, if anybody today is going to say, I'm going to be the Messiah, they have to be from Bethlehem. What percentage of people on that grounds are eligible to be the Messiah? Pretty small. But then there's Isaiah 9, verses 1 through 6. It says, "In the past, he humbled Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he'll honor Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan." And you continue on to verse 6. "To unto us a child is born. He'll be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." He's talking about the Messiah, God in the flesh. He says he's going to come from Zebulun and Naphtali. Now, where is Zebulun and Naphtali? All right, let's... Here we go. Now, this is one of those maps in the back of your Bible with all the tribes. Now, you see where Zebulun and Naphtali are? The blue one is Zebulun. The orange one is Naphtali. See that black dot there, what, Dabarath or whatever, at the border of the two? Now, I'm going to show you where Nazareth is. You see where Zebulun and Naphtali are? Now, let me show you where Nazareth is. Okay. And Nazareth is right on the border between Zebulun and Naphtali. So if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you have to be born in Bethlehem, but you have to come from the neighborhood right in the region between Zebulun and Naphtali. Now, how many people meet those qualifications? I mean, in all the history of the earth, how many people have met those qualifications? I don't know, maybe half a dozen. I don't know. So now, could Jesus have arranged, because remember the skeptics saying, well, you know, he's reading the Old Testament and saying, well, I've got to do this and this and this. How about this? Could he have arranged this one? Could he have arranged to be born in Bethlehem? The answer is, sure. If he's God, and he is. All right, another example. I love this one. Psalm 22, verses 16 through 18. This is David talking. He says, "Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men have encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing." Now, David must have written this and then kind of gone, why did I just write that? What the heck am I talking about? You know, sometimes you read the Psalms and you ask, is he talking about himself or is he talking about Jesus? The answer is yes. Yes, he's doing both. None of this ever happened to David. Now, he says, they have pierced my hands and my feet. Can anybody here figure what that one's about? I think that's actually pretty easy to think about. We know exactly what he's talking about. Did you know, because David lived around 1000 BC, did you know that crucifixion wasn't even invented until the Persians, about 300 BC? 700 years after David wrote? And actually, the Persians didn't actually pierce the hands and the feet. The Romans were the first ones to actually pierce the hands and the feet. So how did David, who lived about 850 years before piercing by hands and feet was even invented, how did he know this? And what about counting all his bones? You know what that's about, right? That's about the fact that his bones weren't broken, which is a historical fact. And then it says, they cast lots for my clothing. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. Now, which is it? Was it one for you, one for you, one for me? Or did they gamble? Which did they do? They did both. They did both. They divided the garments. You just read the accounts. Just read the accounts in John 19. Now, unless the gospel writer is lying, but, you know, one thing I've learned is when people are telling lies, they give as few details as they can. You know what I'm saying? When they're trying to sort of tell a story. But instead, the gospel writers give these tiny little details as if to say, so ask anybody you want, check it out, see it for yourself. So what they did was, they one for you, one for you, one for me, but then they came to that last one, that which was one piece woven all the way around, so very valuable. Now, do you think Jesus said, oh, by the way, guys, you know, that one's valuable. I think you should gamble over that. No, I don't think so. So, at some point, the skeptic surely would notice these things, and yet they don't. Why not? Is that because the Bible's not inspired by God? I mean, it is so obvious the Bible's inspired by God here. All right, let me see, two more. Zechariah 11, it says, I told them, if you think it best, give me my pay. But if not, keep it, so they pay me 30 pieces of silver. Who's saying this? If you read in Zechariah, it's God that's saying this. God is saying that they're going to buy me for 30 pieces of silver. Now, what was the actual buying price for Jesus? Does anybody know? 30 pieces of silver. No, not 29, folks, not 31. It was 30. Right? 30. How did Zechariah, who wrote around 450 BC, how did he know it was 30 pieces of silver? And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter. Now you think, well, you know, maybe this was written afterwards. But see, we have fragments of Zechariah in the Dead Sea Scrolls, 100, 150 BC. And it was translated in the Septuagint translation, 200 BC. And the Lord said to me, throw it to the potter, the handsome price at which they priced me. So I took the 30 pieces of silver, I threw it to the house of the Lord, to the potter. And you know what happened to the money, right? Judas probably was trying to force Jesus' hand to get him to start a rebellion. And he thought, I'll kind of force his hand. It didn't work, because that was not Jesus' plan all along. And so Judas realized, oh my God, I mean, you know, I'm getting him killed. And what he should have done is just repent. He could have repented. Peter repented. Instead, he committed suicide. But before he did, he came in, he threw the money back at them. And they said, we can't take that money, because it's blood money. And what did they do? They bought a field that was known as the Potter's Field. How's that for a specific prophecy? Almost 500 years before it happened, Zechariah said 30 pieces of silver. And the money would go to buy the house of the potter. And some people don't believe the Bible's inspired by God. I'm thinking, why not? It's making me a little suspicious. Last one. Daniel 9. This is my favorite, I think. This is a prophecy of Daniel. He says, the angel says to Daniel, 70 sevens are decreed for your people in your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal a vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. And you know what the Hebrew word for anointed is, right? Messiah. Know and understand this, from the issuing of the decree to restore and build Jerusalem, until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens, it goes on. See, this is, if there is ever a prophecy in the Old Testament that's obviously about the Messiah, it's this one right here. The anointed one, the ruler, comes to Jerusalem. So it says 70 sevens. Anybody got a calculator on that? You don't need a calculator for that, do you? 7 times 7, added 490. 490 what? Well, apparently 490 years. Now, when was there ever a decree written to restore and rebuild Jerusalem? Well, it turns out actually, Cyrus said, go back and rebuild the temple. That was in 538 BC. But he did not give them permission to rebuild the city. No, it was Artaxerxes, who was the fourth ruler of Persia after Cyrus, who told Nehemiah and told Ezra to go back and rebuild the wall of the city. And you can actually read about it being rebuilt. And the decree is in Ezra chapter 7, and it gives you what year of Artaxerxes. In fact, it's 458 BC. All right, so 490 years. Let's see. 458 BC, 490 years later, 458 minus 490. All right, that's negative 32. So what year is that? All right, 458 minus 490, that's negative 32. So what year is that? 32 AD, except for this fact, there was no year zero. There was no year zero. So that means 33 AD. 33 AD. So here we have a prophecy that the Messiah is going to come to Jerusalem in 33 AD and be killed to bring in everlasting righteousness. That's pretty specific. By the way, if you read the passage carefully, it really says during the last week. You see that let me see, the 7-7, 62-7. You read it carefully. It really is during the last week. So the prophecy is really somewhere between 26 AD and 33 AD. Somewhere in that range is when the Messiah will be killed and bring in everlasting righteousness. Actually, it's probably 30 AD. I don't. That's pretty good. That's pretty good if you ask me. So, if anybody's going to claim, anybody here want to claim to be the Messiah? Anybody want to claim that? Now, if you want to claim to be the Messiah, you have to make sure you're born in Bethlehem, raised in Galilee, kind of near the city of Nazareth. You have to be despised and rejected by men. Few of you meet that qualification. You have to be meek and silent when you're accused. You have to be pierced, yet crucified. You have to have your garments divided, but also gambled over. You have to be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. Plus, you have to be God, by the way. That's a minor problem there. And you have to come to Jerusalem to bring in everlasting righteousness somewhere right around 30 AD. And by the way, I'm skipping how many other prophecies? So, you know, just like I said, you know, Moses, he got all the right meats that are healthy and all the right meats that are not healthy. And you could say, well, maybe he got lucky. What were the chances? But then they also got right about the hyssop and about the circumcision on the eighth day and about Hattusha and the Hittites and it's the third in the kingdom and about the 30 pieces of silver. At some point, come on now. People who say the Bible is the word of man, you know, people say belief in the Bible is irrational. I see unbelief in the Bible is surely irrational. In fact, doesn't God tell us why people don't believe? It's in Romans chapter 1. It's because they willfully choose to ignore the obvious. They want to worship the created rather than the creator. But I don't agree with that. Now, all right, so we have faith. What are we going to do with it? Because if the Bible is the Word of God, I think we need to put it into practice. This is not just an intellectual exercise. In fact, some people say, oh, why are you always talking about all this evidence for Christianity? Because really, isn't faith belief in things you can't see? Absolutely. That's the message of Hebrews 1, 11:1. That it's faith in things you can't see. So if all you do is gather all this knowledge of why you should believe in the Bible, that's not really very useful. What it should do is make you able to step out of faith even more. Right? So the more knowledge you have, the more evidence you have, the more faith you should have. I'll tell you right now, I cannot prove to you that you will be raised from the dead. I can't do it. I can't do it. Scientifically, that's craziness, right? How do you know that someday you will be raised from the dead and that you will have judgment and have eternal life or eternal punishment? How do you know that? How do you know that? Because it's by faith, because it's in the Bible. How do you know that God is in control of your life? How do you know that if you step out on faith, it's going to work out? How do you know that? See, I can't prove any of that to you. You know, the Word of God is going to be our judge. James 1:22, it says, you need to put it into practice. It doesn't take a lot of faith, to be honest with you, to believe that the Bible is inspired by God. To me, I mean, come on, how could you not believe it? To me, it takes faith to live the Christian life. It takes faith to share your faith when people laugh at you. That takes faith. It takes faith to give up a job, a great job, to take a job that your parents think you're crazy for taking, right? Sharon Yang was telling me that story. His father thought, especially in Singapore. It takes a lot of faith to make your life as a sacrifice. So, you know, it's good to have this evidence, but I'd say we need to put that faith into practice. We need to step out on faith. We need to walk by faith. We need to live by faith. Abraham, the moment he left Ur, the rest of his life was walking by faith. And that's what we need to do. So anyway, that's all I have to say. We could take some questions and answers if you'd like. Thank you for coming.
Okay, so basically now we have a Q&A session. If you have any questions, you can put your hand and get us so that John can directly answer you. Oh, we have some paper and pen, isn't it?
Don't be shy. Raise your hand. It's okay. All right, good.
My name is Anthony. Uh-huh. My question is that actually there are a lot of unbelievers. So some people already know about Bible, but still they don't believe. Maybe the knowledge is not enough.
Yeah.
But some, maybe I think especially the Jews, those the Jewish people, they among those Jewish people, I think there are many. I think Jewish people is the one of that very smart people. So already, I think they had a lot of time to study Bibles.
Okay.
They know about the Bible very well.
Okay.
Then why they don't they believe in Jesus Christ?
Okay. Do we lose our
scientific factors?
Right. So she's saying, you know, if anybody should believe in Jesus, it should be the Jews.
Yeah.
And besides, the Jews are so smart. I'm not sure they're actually smarter than other people. That's kind of the stereotype. I'm not sure if I buy that. You know, in America, we think the people from Singapore are so smart. I think it's because they study so hard. But anyway, but think about this. Actually, many of the Jews did believe. In fact, during the time of Jesus, I'm not sure, but I would imagine that, we can't really do this calculation, but I would imagine a greater percentage of the Jews became true Christians than the other people. But what the thing is, it generally doesn't have to do with the evidence, it has to do with the heart. The problem with people who don't believe, it's not because of the evidence, it's because of their heart. You see the story of Lazarus? When Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, you know that? And it says, because of that, many people put their faith in him. I kind of go, well, yeah, you would think so. But some people, rather than put their faith in him, they decide to kill him. Why? Because they could see the writing on the wall too, couldn't they? Because they knew they're going to have to repent. And, you know, I'm not here to judge somebody. I can't speak for somebody who's not in the room, but I'm thinking for most of them, it's because they don't want to repent of their sins and accept that they're a sinner. It's worth noting that in the Jews have their regular readings. You know, like in Catholic or Lutheran churches, every week they have a certain thing they read. You know how they do that? Well, the Jews had a number of readings in their regular services, which were prophecies of the Messiah, which after the time of Jesus, they took out of their regular readings. You know why? Because people would read that and would kind of go, wow, sounds like Jesus. All right, so before you start saying, well, how come the Jews don't believe? I think probably at least as many Jews come to become Christians as anybody else. That's been my experience. Some of my best friends are Jewish in the church. My good friend Philip Lester and another one, and their father, who's like 76 years old, has been a Jew for 76 years. He was baptized not too long ago. So, you know, I just think it's because of their sin, like anybody else. Okay, another question? We'll take written ones, I guess.
Bible.
Uh-huh. Why are the Catholic and Christian Bible different? Are the additional books in the Roman Catholic Bible accurate? And therefore, the normal Christian Bible isn't complete. All right, so the Catholic Bible includes what's known as the Apocrypha, which is Tobit, Judith, the additions to Daniel, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, Wisdom of Ecclesiasticus. You could read them. The reason that those are not in the New Testament is because the Jews don't accept them as part of their Bible. Actually, it turns out, if you study the history of Christianity, Jesus never quoted from any of those books. Never. He never did. And neither did the apostles ever quote from any of those books, except possibly one little quote in Jude. Thank you. And yet, obviously, they quoted from all the books of the Old Testament. They're constantly all over the place. So the Jews did not accept them as the Word of God. But it turns out that when the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew to Greek, it's called the Septuagint translation. At the same time, there were a number of other Hebrew writings, such as Ecclesiasticus, Wisdom of Sirach, and all the 1st and 2nd Maccabees. And so the Jews would read those as well. They were not part of their official canon, but they would read them. And so the Christians, in the 1st and 2nd century, they didn't use those very much. But by the 3rd and 4th century, the church was using a lot. Why? Because it became part of the Septuagint translation. It wasn't part of the Jewish canon, but it was part of the Greek translation of the Old Testament. And so the church got used to using it so much that when the Bible was translated into Latin, all right, they included, there's a guy named Jerome, and this is around 430 AD. So Jerome made what's known as the Vulgate translation into Latin, which became the standard Bible of the Western Church. Jerome did not want to include those books. He specifically said those are not canonical, they shouldn't be included. But basically he was told, well, too bad, translate them, and he did. So it became part of the Latin Vulgate. Actually though, it's worth noting, even the Protestant churches, until about 1750, also used those books. So even the King James, you've heard of the King James translation? The King James translation actually included those extra books. It was only later, in about the 1700s, that most Protestants stopped using them. The reason they stopped using them is because they're not part of the Jewish Old Testament. And that's why. And anyway, you can read them. I like to tell a joke, but I shouldn't. It's not very funny. Borrow your Catholic friend's Bible, they're probably not reading it. Bad joke. That's bad. I didn't say that, and it's not. Take that off the tape, please. But anyway, but seriously, just borrow, get a Catholic Bible. I think the New Jerusalem translation includes it, and all Catholic Bibles. Just read it. I mean, read Tobit. You read Tobit, you kind of go, okay, you know. And if you read 2nd Maccabees, at the end of 2nd Maccabees, it says, you know, I did the best I could. There's many mistakes in here, but please forgive me for my mistakes. Can you imagine that being in, say, the book of 2nd Kings? It's crazy. So, but on the other hand, 1st Maccabees is pretty good. I mean, if I read 1st Maccabees, the history there is very, very accurate. All right, so, and then if you read in...